You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a government watchdog is recommending that Kellyanne Conway be removed from federal service for repeatedly violating the Hatch Act. We'll get the details and what the rules mean for federal employees when they talk about politics. Right now, warmer weather means we have the chance to enjoy our many lakes and rivers, but it can also bring toxic blooms of cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae. In Green Bay, city officials and local researchers have been tracking the size and timing of blooms in the bay, and now they're getting a new partner to help them out, NASA. This year, Green Bay accepted the agency's invitation to join an international water monitoring effort, becoming one of just three freshwater sites in the U.S. included in that program. Kevin Firmanick is a professor of geoscience and environmental science at UW-Green Bay, where he researches groundwater quality and watershed monitoring. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, it's my pleasure.
Well, now Green Bay's wastewater utility is joining up with NASA as part of this big monitoring program for algae in the Great Lakes. We'll talk about that algae. I'll put quotes around it for now. But how is this going to work? How is the local government teaming up with the space agency?
Yeah, well, NASA scientists use satellites to study, the Earth's atmosphere and the surface of the entire globe, really. And one of the major applications is to understand water quality of oceans and freshwater systems like Green Bay. So one of the primary partners working with NASA is the Green Bay Metropolitan Sewage District, or New Water. And they've been sort of a leader in monitoring water quality of Lower Bay and Fox River for over 30 years. So NASA is interested in partnering with them to gain some of the ground truth information about the water quality so that when they use their satellites, they can have a better understanding of how accurate they are and do a better job of predicting what the water quality would be.
Let's talk about what we're monitoring here. It's what a lot of us call blue-green algae, actually more technically cyanobacteria. Do I have that right?
Right, that's correct, yeah. So cyanobacteria basically are microorganisms that grow out in the water, and they often are triggered by excess nutrients that get in the water, such as phosphorus or nitrogen. And when they bloom, they sometimes can produce harmful toxins that are harmful to humans as well as pets and potentially other wildlife.
And when these bacteria die, they can take whole areas out with them in some ways. That they're partly responsible for what we call dead zones?
Well, right. Just basically all algae that grows out in the water, when it after it blooms and dies, it sinks to the bottom where it's decomposed by other bacteria and so on. And during that decomposition process, it uses up the oxygen that's in the water, and we can create zones of hypoxia or dead zones, as you mentioned.
How big a problem is cyanobacteria in Green Bay?
Well, I guess we really don't know at this point. So one of the efforts that New Water and other partners like Wisconsin DNR and UW-Milwaukee and UW-Madison and others are working on is to have a better understanding of the impacts and the severity of cyanobacteria and harmful algal blooms. We know that it exists and that at times there are definitely higher levels of toxins in the water that might impact the safety for people.
You mentioned nutrients and excess nutrients being one of the causes of these cyanobacteria blooms. What kind of things are we as humans doing to add those nutrients into Green Bay?
Sure. So from our work that we've done in the watershed and others, we know that about 1.2 million pounds of phosphorus sort of runs out off the landscape and from our wastewater treatment plants into the river and the Fox River and ends up in Green Bay. And the sources of those nutrients, and particularly phosphorus, are both wastewater treatment plants as well as urban runoff. But the primary contributor in our area and for Green Bay is runoff of phosphorus from the landscape, primarily from our agricultural lands, partly because they're a major land user and impact on the landscape. So that phosphorus could be coming from fertilizers, but also from manure as well.
Talking to Kevin Furmanek, professor of geoscience and environmental science at UW-Green Bay, talking about a cooperative program between NASA and Green Bay's water utility to try to monitor dangerous cyanobacteria in Green Bay. This is just one of, as I understand it, three projects, Kevin, around the country like this kind of local partnership with NASA. What is it? You were starting to touch on this earlier. What is it that made Green Bay a logical place to do this?
Right. So Green Bay, like other areas, particularly around the Great Lakes, the embayments like Western Lake Erie and Saginaw Bay, does suffer from harmful algal blooms. And there's a lot of active research to better understand that. And one of the key factors why NASA partnered with New Water is that they, again, have over 30 years of aquatic monitoring data that they've been working on, and they regularly go out onto the Fox River and into the bay and measure the nutrient levels and other parameters like the amount of algae that's out in the bay at various locations throughout the bay. So because New Water has this established program, they really were an ideal partner to work with NASA to get this ground truth data that's so valuable to understand the satellite data.
And that ground truth you're talking about, so this will allow NASA to say, okay, here's the satellite images we have. Now let's see what the surface monitors are telling us and make sure what we've got everything calibrated properly and we know how to understand what we're reading from orbit.
Yes, that's exactly right. And of course, the value of having the ground truth data is that, again, it allows them to have a lot more confidence in what they're seeing, both at the locations where the ground truth data is, but also when they start to estimate or predict or model what the water quality is in other areas where there is no monitoring happening by someone out on the water or on the ground.
One piece of information I'm curious about, this won't just tell us about how much cyanobacteria, so-called blue-green algae, is out in Green Bay. Will it also let us pinpoint when we see blooms and then try to correlate that with what we're doing up on the land?
Yes, for sure. Now, we are limited to the amount of when the times at the satellite are traveling over, you know, Green Bay. So it might be once a day, depending on a particular satellite, or every 7 or 8 days. So we are limited by that type of satellite data. And then, of course, you also have to take into account clouds that might obscure, you know, the satellite's view of the bay. But beyond that, the ability of the satellites to do this on a regular basis and also to begin to put together the information, let's say, from the previous measurement, whether it's the previous day or the previous week, add in some other information like weather and runoff, we can create ways to predict what the likelihood of a harmful algal bloom might be.
Will this ultimately help us in efforts to control the flow of nutrients into Green Bay? Will this help us point toward when we should be taking special action to, I don't know what, control runoff at some at some point in the process?
Sure. Yeah, I think so, because a number of things. One, it's going to build awareness. So if we have a better understanding both within the scientific community as well as the general public of when these algal blooms are happening, what you know, the severity of the algal blooms, maybe a way to actually visualize what it means rather than giving them a concentration of algae out in the water, you can actually sort of see this phenomena happening. I think it'll help maybe spur some of our actions to better control the sources of the nutrients on the landscape. And then again, as you mentioned, I think the timing, having a better understanding of the timing of these events, algal blooms, will help us to better think about when do we need to have particular controls in effect, or how extensive do we need to have the controls across the landscape.
And on a related note, on Tuesday and Wednesday this week, I understand the International Joint Commission, a group that focuses on the Great Lakes and boundary waters, will be holding public meetings in Milwaukee. Do you know what's going to be focused on there?
Yeah, so the International Joint Commission is, you know, an organization that's really a binational treaty organization, or an organization responsible for helping us enforced there by national treaties between Canada and the United States. And they're really interested in all aspects of the Great Lakes, in particular the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement and how we implement that. That is an agreement that looks at setting standards and water quality information to help us manage the lakes for, you know, long-term sustainability and for multiple uses and so on. So it's my understanding the IJC is meeting in Milwaukee to take in information from the public about what they want to see in the Great Lakes and what they want the parties, the United States and Canada, to be working on to protect the Great Lakes.
We'll leave it there. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
Kevin Firmenich is a professor of geoscience and environmental science at UW-Green Bay. He was with us to talk about the city partnering with NASA to monitor cyanobacteria, or blue-green algae, in the waters of Green Bay. You can find out more about those public meetings on Great Lakes issues happening in Milwaukee at ijc.org. Coming up, we'll talk about the federal Hatch Act after one of the president's top advisors was found to be routinely violating it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a political science professor who says American politics and society have changed, but our political institutions aren't keeping up. First, a government watchdog recommended last week that presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway be removed from her post and from working in the federal government. That stemmed from what the agency says are repeated violations of what's called the Hatch Act. That's a Depression-era law that restricts government employees from engaging in politics in their official capacities. Michelle Yehi Lee is a national political enterprise and accountability reporter for The Washington Post. She recently wrote about the story. She joins us now from Washington. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what exactly does this Hatch Act do when it comes to federal employees?
So the Hatch Act is designed to make sure that federal government employees are not essentially politicking in their job. So it has guidelines, sets expectations for what's legal and what's illegal in terms of political activity when you're in your job. I mean, if you think about it, these are employees who are being paid by the taxpayers, working on the taxpayers' dime. And if they are politicking, then that's inappropriate and irresponsible use of the taxpayers' money. So it was passed in 1939. So it's a really, it's been around for a long time to make sure that there are certain standards that government employees must follow in their work.
Who is in charge of tracking this?
So the Office of Special Counsel, which is not the same office as the one that oversaw the Russia investigation under the Justice Department, it's a separate office, and it is in charge of making sure that it investigates complaints regarding violations, potential violations of the Hatch Act. It can recommend disciplinary measures for employees. It can prosecute violations by civil servants, mostly through the Merit Systems Protection Board. So essentially, it could impose disciplinary action against civil servants, even political appointees within federal agencies. But because Kellyanne Conway is a presidential appointee who serves at the pleasure of the president and his decision whether or not to fire or hire her, the Office of Special Counsel can do nothing other than recommend her removal. And when it did so, it was quite a significant step that the office took to recommend that the president take action against her. But ultimately, it comes down to what the president wants to do. And after the Office of Special Counsel recommended her removal, he said that he doesn't plan to do so.
We'll give a listen to President Trump in just a moment. But first, can you talk about what exactly the office, the enforcers of the Hatch Act, said Kellyanne Conway had done wrong?
Sure. The Office of Special Counsel said that she is a quote-unquote repeat offender of violating the Hatch Act. So several times in the past 2 years or so, the investigator had found potential concerns and also violations, a pattern of what they said are violations of the Hatch Act. They found that there were ethics violations that she made. For example, once she was found to have made an ethical violation by touting the clothing line sold by the president's daughter when she was in an interview in the capacity of a White House senior advisor. In another occasion, she made public comments regarding a special election in Alabama in 2018 when she was speaking on behalf of the president and in her official role. And most recently, they found that she violated the Hatch Act because she consistently tweeted about the 2020 Democratic candidature seeking to challenge President Trump eventually. She went on TV and had numerous interviews over several months where she appeared in her official role as a White House counselor, and she commented on politics, and she disparaged Democrats running for the presidential nomination, according to the investigator. And it was kind of like the last straw for them at that point.
Let's give a listen to President Trump now when he was asked if he would take action against Conway. Here's what he told Fox News last week.
It looks to me like they're trying to take away her right of free speech, and that's just not fair. They ask a question, I think one of them was involved with your show, but you ask them a question, or you ask a person a question, and every time you're supposed to say, I can't answer. I mean, she's got to have a right of responding to questions. It really sounds to me like a free speech thing.
But that's kind of the point of the Hatch Act, right? That as a federal employee on the federal dime, your free speech is limited in your federal capacity.
Right. And it's actually quite strict the way that the Office of Special Counsel applies this. And, you know, they really believe that if you are speaking in your official role, for example, as a White House counselor, then you should not be towing that line between possible politicking or not. I mean, they believe that you should be responsible and really stay away from even a potential violation. And clearly, you know, the White House and the president and the Office of Special Counsel don't agree on this front. The president has privately told his advisors, and we've reported this out, that he just doesn't think that the Hatch Act violations amount to much, and he just wants his employees and the people closest to him to be able to say what they want to defend him, and he doesn't see it as a violation. And frankly, as long as the president doesn't see it as a violation, because he's the only one who can enforce this against those he hired directly to work for him, there's no one else who can tell him otherwise.
Michelle Yehi Lee is with us from the Washington Post, looking at the Hatch Act and a recommendation from a special watchdog, a federal watchdog, that Kellyanne Conway, presidential counselor, be removed from her federal job for violating it. Michelle, I've been reading on past actions on the Hatch Act under the Obama administration, under the George W. Bush administration. It looks like, in effect, there have been warnings to some cabinet officials and others. The response has generally been whoopsie-doozle. I'm paraphrasing there. Sorry about that. We won't do it again. That's part of what the current special counsel is saying isn't happening here, that it appears to be their recommendations have been ignored throughout the last couple of years.
Right. And traditionally, well, at least under the Obama administration, there were a couple high-profile cabinet members or White House appointees, presidential appointees, who have been found to be in violation or have really, you know, done some inappropriate things. And the White House did take some measures. You know, you can reprimand the employee, and the White House has done that in certain numbers of cases. I mean, there weren't, you know, falling over backwards to try to accommodate these findings. But there have been cases where they have said, you know what, this was a violation, and we will make sure to do trainings and let our employees know what the standards are. In this case, what the Office of Special Counsel has found is that there is an act of defiance, is what they called it, even though that they have repeatedly found violations. They feel like there's not been enough action done. And the thing is that it's not just Kellyanne Conway. It's several other administration officials who the office has found to be in violation of the Hatch Act. And they have found what they, in their view, is kind of minimal training when it comes to the expectations of cabinet officials and White House employees. When the president announced his reelection, the Office of Special Counsel released guidelines for what White House officials can tweet and not tweet in their official capacity. So basically, the office said, okay, here are the updated social media guidelines since the president is running for reelection. If you use your official Twitter account to use, for example, hashtag Make America Great Again, or show photos or talk about his 2016 campaign, then you're essentially politicking for the president's reelection, and we recommend against that. And they published this guideline. So the employees got trainings regarding this guideline. But now what we're finding out is that the White House counsel, the lawyer for the White House and the president, doesn't think the office should be issuing guidelines at all, and that it's not under that office's jurisdiction to tell employees what to tweet and what not to tweet. So now we're finding that, okay, even though the Office of Special Counsel laid out very clear guidelines about what employees can tweet and not tweet, the president just doesn't think that that's what the office should be doing.
And who is in charge of that office now?
The person in charge of the office now is Henry Koerner. He is a longtime prosecutor. He has a very strict legal background. And interestingly enough, he is was appointed by President Trump. And for him to really speak out on this issue, not only recommend the removal of Kellyanne Conway, but then subsequently to talk to us and say that this is unprecedented and Kellyanne Conway's behavior is unprecedented and setting an example, a bad example in his view for the federal workforce. I mean, that was quite remarkable that he came out so strongly and it was clear how strongly he felt about this.
As we wrap up, Michelle, the next step is what? I guess nothing if the president decides not to enforce this recommendation?
I mean, it's really up to the president, although the legal experts that I've talked to who are more critical of the way the president is handling this believe that if Democrats in Congress really wanted to, Democrats in the House really wanted to pursue impeachment charges, they think there's a legal case for this to be one of the articles of impeachment. I mean, you know, that's with the caveat that there are several jumps that have to be made to actually bring an impeachment case against the president. But how these legal experts view this is that the president must uphold federal law. The Hatch Act is a law, and he's not enforcing the law, and therefore Congress can hold him to account for that. And I mean, that's who knows if that'll actually play out, but at least in the meantime, it's truly up to the president.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michelle Yehi Lee from The Washington Post. She was with us today to talk about the Hatch Act after a federal watchdog recommended Kellyanne Conway be fired for, they say, repeatedly violating it. Coming up, we talk about the state of American democracy with a political science professor and hear her thoughts on how our political institutions today are mismatched with a changing society and politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, John Munson and his guests look at big stories in Wisconsin's forests, the risk of car deer crashes, the stories that are told by tree rings, and threats to trees that have a special significance for Native Americans here in the state. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, our next guest writes, simply put, the structures of American democracy have failed to keep pace with the changes in politics and society. Julia Azari is Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. She's been thinking a lot about America's political institutions and how they relate to what she describes as a political crisis in our country right now. Julia wrote about this for Foreign Affairs magazine. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Before we get to the bad news you lay out in your piece, Julia, you start off with some kind of good news as you see it. A lot of political participation and a lot of people being represented in American politics who might not have in the past. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So some of this comes out of this conversation that people across the ideological spectrum have been having for really about 4 years now. Since President Trump appeared on the scene as a candidate for the Republican nomination in 2015, there's been this kind of conversation about what's gone wrong in American political institutions. And a lot of it has a kind of nostalgic tone. And, you know, I've kind of it's hard for someone like me to hear that and not think, well, you know, in 1965, I probably wouldn't have been on this stage with you or writing in this magazine. And there's a lot of people to whom that applies who are women or people of color or LGBT people who are living life as themselves. And I think what, as I pointed out in the piece, you really saw that reflected in political institutions in the 2018 elections. You really saw a number of candidates of all different kinds of demographic backgrounds win positions of power. So one of the things I pointed out in the article is that a wider range of types of people have access to power than ever before. And as we think about this political crisis, I think it's important not to get too wrapped up in the nostalgia.
But there is a crisis, a political crisis, a crisis of governance. Before we get into the causes, how does that manifest itself? What are the symptoms we're seeing?
I think the biggest one is really in this kind of lack of ability to move forward on solutions to public policy problems. And to some degree, I think the gridlock in political institutions, and I'm thinking specifically of, you know, Washington and the U.S. Congress, reflects the divisions in society. But I think, you know, that's really starting to stress people out. When I speak to young people, as I often do as a college professor, they're, you know, again, all across the ideological spectrum are concerned with the economy. They're concerned with job opportunities. They're concerned with the environment. And I think, you know, we're not in a situation where we have a really healthy process of governance that can take a lot of different perspectives and turn that into some kind of forward movement on public policy.
You look at three fundamental concerns in our political system underlying a lot of this. I want to take them one at a time. You're right. One thing is that political representation, going back to the founding of the U.S., is tied to states and local districts. But our political conversation is more and more all about the national level. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so this is, I'm drawing a lot on a 2018 book by another professor at the University of Pennsylvania, Dan Hopkins, who writes a lot of this and documents the ways in which, you know, attitudes about the president are now affecting how people vote in state and local offices, how the news media has become increasingly national. And so all politics is national, and yet our structures are all localized. And so there's kind of a disconnect there in terms of how people can express themselves politically, and in terms of how members of Congress, you know, specifically are held accountable to their constituents. That all happens at a state and local level. And then they go off and they really are participating in a kind of national partisan conversation.
And you write that in many ways, the founders assumed that citizens of the United States would think of themselves as citizens of a state first and foremost, and then the national, the federal level would be kind of another layer away. And that clearly doesn't seem to be the way things work now.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously when you talk about what the founders thought, there are many different people with different kinds of perspectives. But that was just a much more obvious way to think about who people were and how they might locate themselves in their political communities. The idea that we would someday have a huge nationally integrated political community, I think, is probably hard to imagine prior to mass communication and mass transit. So in a lot of ways, it's a relatively recent development that our politics is really truly, you know, nationally integrated, and where you don't have, for example, distinct regional factions of each party. That's only, you know, maybe several decades old as a phenomenon. There were conservative Southern Democrats really in Congress until about 10 years ago. There were still a handful.
How does that, though, interfere with the ability of, say, Congress to get things done? The fact that they're being judged more on this national level than as our local person in Congress?
And I think it happens in a couple of ways. One is that this, you know, one phenomenon that's come out of this is that if people are really thinking about politics in terms of these two national teams, there isn't a lot of sense of collaboration across. Well, people may disagree locally about some philosophical issues. They may be Republicans and Democrats, but together they want to advocate for the interests of their district. And then you might see some trading back and forth among members of Congress. As far as the interests of their districts, you might see more collaboration across party lines from people of, from the same state or locality. You do still see that to some degree, but the nationalization of partisan politics has eroded it to some degree.
Julia Azari is with us, professor of political science at Marquette University. Talk about a piece you wrote in Foreign Affairs magazine looking at big shifts in American politics that can lead to a lot of dysfunction in our national politics today. Another point you raise is that you write that elections just were de-emphasized in the Constitution, but they matter more and more these days in practical terms. What do you mean by that?
So this one is really deeply close to my heart. I wrote a book about presidential mandate claiming that came out in 2014. And one of the things that I found there is that presidents have become more and more eager to emphasize election results. And it's become a kind of expected part of presidential rhetoric after an election, no matter how close or how, you know, they may have lost the popular vote and won the Electoral College. But they still there's still kind of a norm that they we'll talk about it. And elections are really how I think many Americans process the idea of democracy, is about who votes, how open is it. And, you know, that's what's seen as legitimizing Democratic politics. And also, as we, you know, as we're in the thick of it now in the summer of 2019, elections are ongoing. We're kind of never not in them. And that really makes it difficult to have some space to govern. And it also means that, as I pointed out in the piece, it's just kind of at odds with how the Constitution is structured, where our elections, they're fixed, they're periodic, they're staggered. So you can have an election like 2016. One of the things I emphasize there is that 2016 was, as there's been a huge amount of narrative building from Republicans and Democrats about what that election meant. And it was, I think, really quite important to President Trump and to Republicans to establish their story about what that election meant about public opinion. Then comes 2018 and Democrats win. And so the question is, or at least they win in the House, the question is, what does that mean? And it's a very similar kind of dynamic. If you look back to 2008, big victory for the Democrats, then midterm 2010, victory for Republicans. So what does that mean for governance? Well, it means that you need to move on from the election being the main source of what you're doing and think about what's good public policy, and then have some processes to work toward that.
It's hard to see how we would get to that point, assuming that it functioned better in the past, maybe a little bit of a golden age there, I don't know. But how do we get to a point where politicians don't think about the election? It seems like they're kind of always looking over their shoulder at the next election.
No, absolutely. And I don't want to downplay the importance of elections as an important way to be held accountable. I think the trick to some extent here is to think about, are you serving your constituents? Are you getting public policy done? Are you doing something you can explain? Versus what did that last election mean? And who now has the right to sort of solely govern and set the agenda? Because very rarely in American politics is the answer to that simple. So it is a little bit tricky. And that's one of the reasons that I picked some of these areas, is because these first two elections and the national versus local they have a lot of push and pull. There's a lot of tension there. You can see arguments for different ways that you might balance these considerations. But the trick is that they're kind of they're in tension now. We don't have a clear roadmap for what the balance should be.
Julia Azari is with us, associate professor of political science at Marquette University, talking about political institutions in the United States, how they've maybe moved away from society as a whole, and how to bridge the gap and create a more healthy democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on how to fix dysfunction in federal government? Do you agree that there is some dysfunction in federal government? What, if anything, do you need to change? Do you have questions for our guest about what we've been talking about so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're talking about America's political institutions and how our guest thinks they don't match up so well anymore necessarily with American politics and society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think your representative government represents you well? How would you change things to make government function better? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. Julia, let's get into the third kind of fundamental point you raise, the colorblindness of American institutions. This will take some explaining. Flesh this out for us.
Yeah, so this one gets into obviously some difficult territory. But one of the things that I thought a lot about having studied the the Civil Rights Act and kind of anti-discrimination policy that really forms the basis of how most Americans, I think about the role of race in our society. And that's kind of, did you overtly discriminate against someone? Are you, are you behaving as a hateful person? And most people, who are in a position to ask themselves that question don't want to believe that about themselves. But that's not the only way that racism plays out. So, in the piece, I refer a bit to Ta-Nehisi Coates' work on reparations, where he talks about the depth of economic inequality between Black and white Americans, and more structural issues like that. We're starting to really, I think, have more of that in the public conversation. And so we really have this mismatch between a story that many people, especially people like myself who grew up in the 80s and 90s, learned that, this is really about non-discrimination. And in fact, it's, the story of what has gone on in the United States and the story of how race affects people's lived experiences is much deeper. And it's not just about all of us asking if we have, bigotry or hatred toward people different from us in our hearts. It's this sort of structure question. And that's much more difficult. It's much more difficult to deal with. Obviously, there are different solutions like the kind that Coates poses. There are people working on this in the criminal justice system. And to some degree, I really think that this gets at a larger point I try to make in the piece, which is I'm a little bit, kind of contradicting my original argument, because I start in with institutions, but really the story that comes out of these institutions is part of the problem is social forces. And part of the problem is that you can change institutions, but there are also problems in society that tinkering with institutions isn't really going to change. So I'm writing this a little bit to have an argument with myself and other people who've been writing about the crisis in American democracy.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in DeForest. Brian, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I guess I've been very interested in this subject for a long time and discussing this with friends, but I do believe systems are a big part of what gets our democracy to work, and I was wondering what your guest thinks about the ideas of possibly like ranked choice voting, public financing of elections, and term limits as ways to help get people maybe with a better interest in civic duty as opposed to the gamesmanship of today's politics.
Brian, thanks for the call. Julia?
Yeah, so these are questions I get a lot. Last year I gave a talk in Maine where they've just implemented some ranked choice voting, and people there are very enthusiastic about it. Let me speak. So that's kind of like the whole, that's a very rich buffet of reforms here. Let me speak to ranked choice voting and then sort of more generally to the question about civic mindedness. So people, as I said, in Maine seem pretty happy with ranked choice voting. I know many people in the political science community are very enthusiastic about that possibility. It could, providing people with more choices might really help with some of the questions of how well represented people feel. The concern that I have is that it makes the electoral system a little bit more complicated. It's a little bit less obvious how votes translate into who wins the election. And that, I think, can have, there is a little bit of research that suggests that can alienate some people. So I think with any of these reforms, you run into the possibility that they might solve some problems, but also some unintended consequences. When it comes to the idea of civic mindedness, I think that's obviously really important that in a democracy, people have some sense that they belong to a political community that they share with others. At the same time, my reading of history is that most of the time, politicians have been politicians. They've had interests. Their constituents have interests. Those interests can mean they have principles, they have ideals, they have things they believe. I don't see that being different today. If anything, a lot of the time, the complaints that we get about our politicians is that they're too ideological. They're too committed to their larger ideals. And so I think, you know, I don't know that that part is what is so different from the past. I think the trick is you've got a lot of people in this country who are engaged in the political process who have very different viewpoints about how things should look. And what's fallen apart is the ability for those people to have some kind of process that brings them to a compromise that everyone feels at least was fair, and that produces solutions to problems that are at least sustainable through, you know, through a couple of election cycles. So I have a somewhat different viewpoint than the caller about precisely what the problem is.
Brian, thanks for that call. Julia Azari is with us from Marquette University, talking about a piece she wrote in Foreign Affairs magazine about some fundamental problems with American political institutions. Julia, given that the people in power were elected and brought into power under the current system, who do you look to fix these problems you're pointing out?
Yeah, that's really tricky. And that's one where, again, you know, there's a couple of things, right? As, you know, as our previous caller pointed out with things like ranked choice voting, changing the voting system a little bit, that can be done at the state level. So you are seeing states and localities experiment with different ways of allocating votes, different kinds of governmental processes. So you're seeing a little bit of that, different rules about voting, things like that. But, you know, so I think you can see that. I think to the degree that people want serious wholesale change, it's interesting to me that you don't have a lot of active social movements that are really agitating for a constitutional amendment. It's really hard to change the Constitution. That's definitely true. But it has happened. So, you know, I think it's kind of interesting. One of the repeated tropes we see in our politics is that something isn't going to happen. So why try? You know, that's like that kind of organizing. We don't really, I'm not seeing as much of that as I would have expected. So I guess that's sort of the answer is if you want something done, you have to get together with like-minded people and start pushing for it.
In just our last few moments, Julia, do you worry about disillusionment with the system based on this dysfunction?
I worry a lot about that. It seems to me that a lot of the political institutions that we depend on, that we could tinker with how they work, but with their kind of fundamental concepts, having a legislature, having political parties, having elections, that though the people are suspicious of those, the media, people, obviously you and I maybe are both a little biased on this, on this subject. But the idea that the media, you know, is not honest or not out to do a good job. You can change all of those institutions, but you have to have some sense of what their purpose is and that there needs to be something in place. And that in any of those kinds of institutions, a legislature, a political party, an election, you're not always going to get what you want. And you have to kind of trust your fellow citizens won't completely throw you under the bus. And that's really where, you know, where my concern lies is in that general lack of trust of fellow citizens that has to underlie a political community.
Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We talked with her about what she sees as a mismatch between our political structures in the U.S. and our role as citizens in moving forward a functioning democracy. You can read her piece over at Foreign Affairs Magazine under the headline, "It's the Institutions, Stupid, the Real Roots of America's Political Crisis." Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, school's out for the summer, but school lunches are up for debate in Congress. We'll learn about a plan to allow whole milk and chocolate milk on the lunch tray and what it all means for student nutrition. Our neighbors in Michigan legalized marijuana for recreational use, but there are lots of gray areas when it comes to putting that into practice. We'll find out what happens after legalization. Plus, we'll look at a new effort in the state legislature to provide insurance for families of police officers. All that tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with John Munson in this week for Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, what's in a word? John talks to a dictionary editor about the stories behind words and how definitions are crafted, and you can join in with your word-related questions and concerns. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, ISIS and other violent extremist groups have used the internet and social media as a recruiting and propaganda tool. We'll talk to a former diplomat who says there's a lot the United States could do to help turn the tide. We'll learn more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.